You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. In his first State of the Union address earlier this week, President Biden announced a strategy for addressing the national crisis around mental health. In a fact sheet the administration released Tuesday, it says the plan is to, quote, strengthen system capacity, connect more Americans to care, and create a continuum of support, transforming our health and social services infrastructure to address mental health holistically and equitably. In his new book, our guest says changes to mental health care are long overdue, but there's good news. He says we know what works. We mostly just need to put it into action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you struggled with mental illness or know someone who has or is doing it right now? What kinds of help have you been able to find? What isn't out there that you wish were out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Thomas Insel is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist who served as director of the National Institute of Mental Health from 2002 to 2015. He started two online platforms to help people with mental illness. He's a special advisor to California Governor Gavin Newsom and the past chair of the board of the Steinberg Institute in Sacramento, focused on brain health policy advocacy. His new book is called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. Dr. Insel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Rob.
On Monday, you wrote on Twitter, quote, I've waited 41 years for a president to talk about mental health. Biden says we have a mental health crisis. Finally, we have an agenda, end quote. Can you expand a bit on what you were seeing from the White House here?
Well, I think what you heard on Tuesday was pretty exciting. Biden's actual words were in the spoken State of the Union, let's take on mental health. But he didn't say a lot. There was a lot of other things to cover in that hour speech. What the White House did earlier in the day was to release a fact sheet that you had just mentioned at the top of the show, talking about the need to go deep in a few areas, especially around building capacity, connecting people to care, and even thinking beyond healthcare about what we need to do to improve mental health, working in schools, working for people who are justice involved, looking at the opportunities to build or rebuild a safety net for those people who may be struggling with severe mental illness. I'm excited about this. I think that it is the first time in really since the Carter administration that the White House has said we care about mental health as a national issue.
You spend time in your book looking at kind of the crisis of mental illness we have in the country, and we'll get into that. But I want to start, I think, with the main takeaway of your book, a very hopeful one, that we have a lot of things that we know can work that can really help people recover. Could you share some of that hope with us?
Absolutely. You know, with most people, when we talk about mental health care and mental health treatment, they immediately start to argue about medications. Are we over-medicated? Are we under-medicated? The fact is, we have a lot to offer, not only for medications, but with psychological treatments and with some new, what we call neuromodulatory treatments like magnetic stimulation. But maybe the most important and least appreciated are all the things that we do in the general realm of helping people recover, things like support for finishing school or getting a job or getting better housing, bringing families into the mental health crisis space so that we can make sure they know how to become part of the solution. There's a lot we can do that we haven't been doing. Some of it isn't particularly high tech. Some of it isn't particularly sexy, but these kinds of rehabilitative services, they really do work. And we know they help people recover. We've had that data for a long time. We're just not paying for them, and we're not often getting them done.
A big concern that you talk about in your book is a large number, maybe 40% is one number you cite, of people who could use some kind of mental health care, any kind of mental health care, have basically zero or maybe an emergency room crisis visit, and that's it. What would it take to get the services they need in a way that they can access them?
Well, access is part of it, right? In many parts of the country, and Wisconsin is no different than anywhere else, there are areas where it is difficult to find anybody in a community who has the expertise to help with these problems. Fortunately, now we can find people online, and there are many, many new services, many of which developed just during the pandemic, to provide high quality mental health care. You know, it's a little different than if you needed high quality surgical care. You actually have to go to a place that has an operating room and be in the same space. For mental health, you can get a lot of what you need by talking with someone who might be remote. And so telehealth has really changed, I think it's really fundamentally changed the way that we provide mental health care. President Biden spoke about that. The fact sheet talks specifically about we need to actually change some of the regulations to make telehealth even easier. But this business of less than half of the people who should benefit actually getting the benefit is not just a problem with access. Mm-hmm. It's a problem with what I call engagement. You know, there's a lot of things that make it difficult for people to get the kind of care they need. And sometimes it is, in fact, there's no one around. But sometimes the illness itself gets in the way. If you're depressed, you're hopeless. If you're anxious, you're avoidant. And if you're psychotic, you probably don't think you're sick. So these are all issues we don't deal with much in the rest of medicine. When people with diabetes or heart disease get ill, the sicker they get, the more likely they are to get care. But in the mental health space, it's just the opposite. The more ill you become, the less likely you are to actually engage in care.
Talking to Dr. Thomas Insull. He's a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, author of the new book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. I want to follow you on a trip you made to Italy, the city of Trieste, where you found an example of maybe something we could aspire to. The cab driver, I think you went with, brought it up as a point of civic pride, even though he didn't know you were working in this field and going there to do research. What were they doing there that maybe could be a model for what we could do here?
Well, there have been several places that have focused on optimizing mental health care. And what Trieste has done over really four decades is to create services within the community. They do have a hospital where people go and when they need to be hospitalized, but what they spend an awful lot of time doing is making sure people are getting the kinds of services that they need to be able to truly recover. So our system here in the United States is mostly focused on symptoms. You know, what we try to do is to make sure that somebody who is depressed or psychotic has relief from those acute symptoms. And often that's done in a crisis. Trieste has made a longer term commitment to say, yeah, we'll help with symptoms, but let's make sure that somebody with a mental illness actually recovers. They actually have a life. So we don't have to worry about suicide because they have something to live for. And even though they may have a psychotic illness, they can still hold a job and have a family. And it turns out that with the appropriate kinds of interventions and with supporting people over the long term, recovery is entirely possible for the vast majority of people with a mental illness, even with very severe mental illness. They don't have to become homeless. They don't end up being incarcerated. And what you see in Trieste is many of them really do thrive, something that should be a source of civic pride. But unfortunately, in the United States, we haven't yet reckoned with the severity of this problem or made the commitment to actually help people recover.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Drew is with us in Fitchburg. Drew, hi.
Hi, thanks for discussing this topic. I wanted to convey that my wife is seeking licensure in the mental health field here in Wisconsin. And I'm helping her do a lot of the legwork with that and have found many, many speed bumps along the way. It has given a good, or I should say a bad name to bureaucracy trying to go through this process. And in a state where there is a dearth of qualified, licensed mental health professionals, it seems like the process should maybe not be easy, but attainable.
Drew, thanks for the call. Dr. Insull, do you see this, that there may be too many hurdles? Is that a concern you have?
Well, I think this is a really interesting question. We don't talk about it enough. We complain a lot about the workforce, but saying we don't have enough therapists or enough providers, but the reality is we don't make it easy. Drew's absolutely right. We have the same situation here in California where you could have been a very successful provider, clinician, therapist in an adjacent state, but you start all over again when you come to California. And I remember at one point, my daughter, who is a social worker and a therapist in a private practice, when we lived in Maryland, in suburban Washington, D.C., she wanted to practice to see patients in Virginia. And it wasn't possible. You need to get an entire different kind of certification for crossing state line that's just 5 miles away. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. We should have national standards. It is important to have standards, but we shouldn't make people who have gone through a lot of training and have a lot to offer jump through so many hoops as they move from state to state. I don't see the sense of that. And it gets even more bizarre when you think that so many people are providing care remotely by teletherapy. And yet they're told they can only do that to somebody who is in the same state. So we actually literally have people on the East Coast who drive up the New Jersey Turnpike from Maryland or Pennsylvania to be able to talk to their patients who are in New Jersey because they're not allowed to talk to them from their homes in Pennsylvania or Maryland. So we ought to fix that. And it's one of the things actually in the White House plan, they talk about trying to update our teletherapy rules. And to Drew's point, just put fewer speed bumps in the way for people who want to provide care.
Thanks for the call, Drew. We are talking to Dr. Thomas Insull, a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health. His new book is called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you glad to hear the president declare a mental health crisis and announce a strategy for dealing with it? If you have had a mental illness problem yourself or in your family, were you able to get help that you needed or that your loved one needed? If you provide a mental health care, love to hear from you and what you think we need that we don't have right now. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with psychiatrist and neuroscientist Dr. Thomas Insull, looking at his new book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. Dr. Insull, you've given some hope here, pointed towards some of the solutions and tools we have. Can you talk a little bit about the scope and the costs of the mental health problem we have and if we don't treat it and don't fix our system?
Well, the scope is vast. Usually when people talk about mental illness, they say, well, you know, it's like 1 in 5 people are affected. I'm not sure that's helpful as a metric. I actually think more about the fraction of people who have what we call serious mental illness, the illnesses that are really affecting someone's ability to function, that really cause disability, schizophrenia, bipolar illness, some of the eating disorders, sometimes PTSD, severe depression. We have about 14.2 million, so about 1 in 20 people in the United States who are disabled by mental illness, and the cost is enormous. We know that in terms of healthcare, the United States spends about $220 billion, but that's just a tiny fraction of what the actual costs for severe mental illness is. It plays out in the criminal justice system, where so many of these people end up being incarcerated. It plays out in the homelessness crisis, where so much money is going, and most of all, in lost productivity. When you add those three together, the number is really closer to $1 trillion in costs, and so much of that can be averted. We can do so much better, considering what we're actually spending by doing it badly, if we were to make the kinds of investments, some of which President Biden alludes to in his document, in his fact sheet, a lot of those costs can come down. So we really ought to think about spending on mental health more as an investment than as a cost, because it it helps us on so many other social issues like crowding in the jails, crowding in emergency rooms, and of course, homelessness as well.
Let's go back to our callers now. Joy is with us in West Bend. Joy, hi.
Thank you. This will be a good segue, I think. I'm a nurse. I've worked in mental health and psychiatric inpatient. I have relatives who utilize mental health care, and I believe that mental health is just like any other disease. It's best if you diagnose it early and get treatment early, then you save money in the long run. But a lot of mental health care is paid for only if it's really an emergency or really a crisis. I would like to know what the doctor thinks about this. We have had at least two or three other times when the government has said we'll have mental health parity, and it hasn't really come true. So I'm wondering, how is this program going to be different?
Joy, thanks for sharing your perspective and experience, Dr. Idsall.
Well, Joy, you brought up two or three things, and I want to just quickly touch on each of them. It is the case that we have a healthcare system for people with mental illness that is really built around crisis. You're absolutely right. It's really a sick care system and a very expensive, not very effective one. Getting there earlier is the key to fixing this. The Mental Health America, one of the big advocacy groups, talks about their campaign for what they call before stage four. And the problem is that so much of what we do in the mental health space is at a very late stage of these illnesses. We know very, very clearly from the science that if you can intervene early with the first episode of psychosis and provide comprehensive, continuous, and compassionate care, you can often prevent a second episode, help people to recover, make sure that they're working instead of on disability. All of that is feasible. We're just not doing it. On the question of parity, you're right. You know, we've actually had two big parity bills, one in 96, another in 2008 or 9, and neither one of them has really changed the reality, which is that people with mental illness are not given equivalent benefits with commercial insurance to those who have a physical illness. It was interesting because the president called that out directly. In fact, he made a recommendation that every American with insurance should have up to 3 behavioral health visits a year without a copay, which I've never heard before. I think that was really kind of laying down the gauntlet. But what has happened, even in the past few months, is for the first time, the federal government has begun to return to this issue. It was a federal law, but it was really passed off to the states to enforce parity. And every state did it differently, but no state did it well. The federal government in the last year said, enough already. We want to actually begin to look at this ourselves. So he's asked, the White House asked Marty Walsh, the Secretary of Labor, to begin to do unannounced site visits for Fortune 500 companies and find out, what is it like for someone in that company who wants to get mental health care? They've got an employee-based plan, but are they able to get the services they need, or do they have to go out of network? And if they do, what sorts of costs are incurred? They did this on 10 companies. Marty Walsh had a press conference early in January. All 10 of them were grossly deficient. And so I think you're seeing in that it's kind of like a new sheriff in town. The federal government is now going to begin to look at the actual enforcement of parity in a way we haven't seen really since either of these laws were passed. And I think that's a really promising sign.
Thanks again for the call, Joy. Reading your book, Dr. Insel, I was thinking of, like, by analogy here, if you went to your doctor and the doctor said, yeah, you're at risk of a heart attack. If you have a heart attack, call 911. And that was it. You know, no cholesterol, blood pressure medication, no exercise, no diet advice, anything like that. That's basically the mental health care system for a lot of people, right?
Well, Rob, it's the case that we don't have biomarkers. We don't have good objective measures. They're being developed, but they're not there. And most of all, in this field, we don't measure things very often. So I think that is a real problem. What's really frustrating for me is that we actually have good treatments. Mm-hmm. I think we have something to offer and we're not doing it. Most people get their mental health care from their primary care doc. And that usually means a prescription for an antidepressant or an anxiety pill or something like that. That's not adequate. Now, we should be able to do better. We have great psychological treatments, but people don't get connected to them, and often they aren't paid for. We ought to figure out how to make sure that people get the care that works.
And just our last half a minute or so, Dr. Insel, do you think we have the will to do that, to make those investments?
You know, I've wondered about that in the past. I think we're at a particular moment, and this may be one of the silver linings of the pandemic, is that it's helped to focus the nation on this particular problem. It's obviously worse with the pandemic. I have to say that it's one of those rare areas today that's really of bipartisan interest. So I have heard from members of Congress, both on the Republican and the Democratic side, and now the White House as well, that they're all really committed to trying to make a difference. So I'm hopeful. I think this is the time.
Dr. Insel, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Thomas Insel, former director of the National Institute of Mental Health. His new book is called Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the January 6th committee says President Trump and associates may have committed criminal acts in their efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. A legal expert joins the show for a look at the accusations and what they could mean. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a personal finance expert joins us to look at the ways that inflation can affect our long-term investments and savings and what we can do about it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelin released his second report on the 2020 election in Wisconsin. We'll hear about the findings of the Republican-backed election investigation and the pushback it's getting. First, inflation has driven up prices for a big variety of goods and services in recent months. In January, consumer prices rose at their highest rate in nearly 40 years. Inflation can mean our paychecks might not go as far at the store, but it can also affect things like our investments and our ability to save for the long run. A financial expert joins us now to talk about what inflation means for our long-term investment and saving plans and what we can do to protect our money. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How is inflation affecting your financial picture? Have you changed the way you save or maybe invest money because of the historically high inflation rates we're seeing right now? Have your wages kept up with inflation over the last year or so? What do you want to know about protecting assets from inflation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Lynette Calfani-Cox, also known as the Money Coach, is a personal finance expert. She's the founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. Her books include the New York Times bestseller, Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. Lynette, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Before we dig into maybe specific assets or specific situations, big picture, what kind of thinking should we be doing about inflation when we're making our long-term money plans?
I think overall, since we know that inflation has hit most folks' wallet pretty hard, you need to be thinking about substitutions in a big way. And what I mean by that is the typical things that you would buy, the typical things that you might have done, probably won't work in this economy when prices are rising so fast. So all of us have to make some sacrifices and or changes. And substitutions in a lot of ways are one good way to deal with inflation.
Sometimes that's easier said than done. I saw one report that said a couple of the highest inflation items were pastries and electricity. I like pastries. I know I'm probably better off without them. I kind of need electricity for a lot of things in my life. Where can we hunt for the low-hanging fruit for that kind of substitution?
Well, I think you have to look at your budget and your everyday expenditures, you know, so the pastries might be something that you say, huh, you know what, instead of me having, you know, X favorite brand, let's, you know, say some, you know, brand name, can I substitute for the store brand? I don't know if they'll be as tasty for you. I don't know if the pastry will, satisfy the sweet tooth there. But the idea in general is that you don't have to deprive yourself overall, but you can use a substitute or a different type of product or service or whatever it is that you're buying that's less costly. And so when you think about things like electricity, yes, certainly we all need to, you know, keep the house and the apartment warm, that kind of thing. But even on that front, there are ways where you can comparison shop and make energy and or utility companies compete for your business to see, can I get the best possible rate? Can I negotiate for something that's, again, less pricey than what I'm currently paying?
Looking at the longer term, people might be thinking, you know, do I need to change my retirement strategy if they have retirement savings or saving for college tuition in 15 years or whatever the case may be? Given that inflation might be around for a while, it might be a year or two long blip. I don't know. Should we be making big changes, do you think, for that kind of long-term thinking, Lynette?
It's a great question, and it really does boil down to folks' time horizon and what the objective is, and frankly, also their level of risk tolerance. So you mentioned two things, for example, on the retirement front that may potentially be decades away for some people, could be 10, 20, 30 years, or maybe somebody who's thinking about sending their kid to college. Well, if you have a, say, 13-year-old, you know, college might just be about 5 years off. If you have a 17-year-old, it might be next year. So you first need to look at what is the time horizon that you have, and as that relates to any kind of investment that you might make in order to meet the specific goal. And then you have to, of course, think about your risk tolerance too, because it's easy for us to tell folks, don't worry about it right now. If you're investing and you have, you know, 10 or 20 years to retirement, you can afford to take more risks. You can afford to be more aggressive, perhaps in the stock market, to have a higher allocation of your portfolio towards equities or stocks. But if a person is not comfortable with that level of risk, if he or she can't sleep at night, you know, kind of loading up the portfolio with stocks, and if you're, you know, kind of freaked out, frankly, by seeing the gyrations of the stock market, and we know there's been a lot going on lately, not just related to inflation, but obviously supply chain disruptions, Russia, Ukraine, all of those things which are causing a tremendous amount of volatility. Simply put, if you're not comfortable with your current asset allocation mix or the, you know, mix that you have in terms of stocks, bonds, cash, or other investments, then that needs to change, because you don't really want to keep yourself up at night. You don't want to have sleepless nights, anxiety, or worries about your portfolio. You should really be able to sleep at night no matter what your investments are.
We're talking to the money coach, Lynette Kalfani-Cox, about saving, investing, and what we do in a time of inflation. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question to share or you want to talk about how inflation has affected you, whether that's in your daily life or your monthly bills, or if you've made longer-term changes. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. We've talked about policy related to inflation on past shows. We're getting personal this time, though. We're not looking for the big politics stuff. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's or email ideas@WPR.org. Lynette, I want to ask about a question I know is close to your heart, part of your superhero origin story as a money coach, and that is debt. You've shared your story on this show, I think, about how you dug out from a huge mound of debt, Can you talk, first of all, a little bit for that person with a lot of debt, some of the basics for a plan, and then we'll ask maybe how inflation can affect that.
Sure. So I was a person who was mired in debt, you know, back in 2001 to 2004, I had $100,000 in credit card debt alone. And yes, it was awful, but thankfully I managed to pay it off in 3 years and never missed a single payment. It is the case that right now, because we're looking at the prospect of the Fed raising interest rates, that people who have debt are going to have a harder time for, you know, harder go of it. And you have to remember, you know, the what our central bank is sort of tasked with doing, right? Their job is to kind of navigate a tricky situation on two fronts. One is they're trying to, you know, maintain a pretty decent level on the employment front, but also to make sure that prices don't rise so quickly. So they're looking at interest rates. I'm sorry, I referenced employment, but they're looking at interest rates and kind of, you know, managing that front, but also looking at things like prices and, you know, whether or not they're skyrocketing. And we know that inflation hasn't been as quote unquote transitory as the Fed initially had hoped. So the Fed has already said to us that they are going to raise rates. And you could, you know, take any number of economists or Wall Street analysts, et cetera. The sort of consensus is for a significant number of moves this year by the Fed, anywhere from 3 to 5 or more interest rate hikes. And so now you as a consumer, if you have things like credit card debt, most of which is variable rate debt, then those rates are going to be rising on you. And the cost of borrowing, of course, is going to get a lot more expensive. And again, not just, of course, for credit cards, but for all types of loans. If you need an auto loan, a student loan, if you're going to get a mortgage, et cetera, borrowing costs are going to be rising in 2022. So you definitely want to manage that debt wisely. And certainly on the revolving debt front, things like consumer debt or credit card debt, you want to knock that out as quickly as possible.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in DePere.
Jerry is with us in DePere.
Jerry, hi.
Jerry, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. Question, retired probably about a year and a half ago, 66 years old, and have our house paid for. But with the current rate of housing and everything else, we get a notice from our city that they will be in we'll be doing assessments this year, and that the housing market is up 20%, which most likely means that our tax rate will go up 20%. And on the other end, I'm watching the investments that we saved for retirement kind of dwindle away week by week. Any suggestions?
Jerry, thanks for the call, and I'm sure Jerry's not alone in this situation, Lynette.
Sure, and appreciate the call, Jerry, and the question. First, on the property front, kudos to you for having paid off your mortgage. You're in the minority there among a growing number of people who actually do have a home loan still on their property. But when it comes to property taxes, you actually do have probably more leverage and flexibility than you might think, because you can indeed appeal your property taxes. So I happen to live in the greater Houston, Texas area, and we relocated from the East Coast to this neck of the woods in 2019. Long story short, last year, tremendous gains in real estate prices here, as well as in 2020. And last year, we got a notice from our tax assessor, from our county tax assessor, saying, hey, valuations have risen. Here's what your new tax bill is going to be. And we said, oh, no, wait a minute. And we did, in fact, appeal. And most people don't know that you can appeal your property taxes in every state, including Wisconsin. And so it's not a matter of you just willy-nilly accepting what the local tax assessor says. You want to get comps. You want to show comparisons for other properties, et cetera. You got to do a little bit of homework, but you can nudge them towards a number, a lower number, that in turn will mean a lower tax burden for you as well. So that's one thing. On the investment front, certainly none of us has control over what happens in the stock market. And it's been a wild ride thus far, obviously, in 2022. You know, we typically have that so-called January effect where you get a nice bounce in stocks. But I mean, if you look at the, you know, all indications, certainly if you're in technology, if you're in anything, even the S&P, you know, if you look at the Dow, et cetera. So all of these indicators are neutral to negative. And so it hasn't been a pretty ride the first couple months of the year. And again, it doesn't help with, you know, sort of, you know, global geopolitical considerations weighing on the markets as well. What I can say is that the best thing to do, and again, I don't know if you need to tap your assets right now since you said you're 66, but if you don't need to sell any securities, I would recommend that you refrain from doing so. If you don't have to live off of those assets, I know it's uncomfortable to kind of sit through it and to kind of ride it out a little bit, but certainly when we find choppy times like they are right now, a lot of this stuff tends to be short-lived. So, you know, Ukraine is a case in point. The day that Russia invaded Ukraine, the Dow Jones futures that morning were off like over 800 points. But miraculously, by the end of the day, the Dow had staged a remarkable comeback and was up about 90 points. So it's uncomfortable to be in there for the ride, but sometimes you really do have to sit it out.
Jerry, thanks for the call. We're talking to Lynette Kalfani-Cox right now, personal financial planner, founder of AskTheMoneyCoach.com. Looking at inflation, how it can affect our investment, our savings, our day-to-day budgeting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about investing, personal finance, getting out of debt during a time of higher than usual inflation? If you have investments, are you worried about what inflation could mean for them? Have you changed your daily buying habits, shopping habits? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation now with personal finance expert Lynette Kalfani-Cox about what inflation means for our savings, our long-term investing, our day-to-day money decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe changes you have made when you hear the news about inflation, when you see the news about inflation in the prices you pay for stuff. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Megan is with us in Eagle River. Megan, hi.
I'm wondering if Lynette could dive into a little bit more the appeals process for her property taxes, what type of research she did, who she appealed to. What is that process like? Thank you.
Megan, thanks for the call. I know things might work a little bit different in the Houston area than in Wisconsin, Lynette, but the basics, if somebody wanted to appeal their property taxes, you talked a little bit about that earlier.
Sure. So the gist of it is that you have to arm yourself with data and documentation. You have to be able to show a tax assessor, whether that's your local county board or a specific official, why it is that your property is not as high in terms of the value that they think it is. So you might check out comps or comparable sales listings in your area for properties that have recently sold or that have been recently listed on the market. And so, of course, you want to give the ones that are lower in value, right? But you'll also want to look at things that are within a certain range. So typically, you know, no more than 1 to 1.5 miles away from where you live. Some people might find good comps, favorable comps, that is, you know, a block, 2 blocks, 3 blocks away, but you might be able to stretch it out a little bit and find a property or properties that are, say, half a mile away or so, that are listed and or recently sold for a lower price than what the assessor is saying the value of your house is. So ultimately, they're kind of basing it on their best guess about market value, and they're putting a tax rate on that basis. So the more that you can show them in terms of empirical evidence, again, data and numbers to back up your assertions and your claims, the more likely they are to see things the way that you do.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Patty in Sheboygan. Patty, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering what your guests' feelings are on I-bonds that you buy directly from the Treasury Department.
I-bonds, Lynette.
Yeah, I think I-bonds are great. And I forget what the rate is right now, or if it's still at, I want to say with some high level, given, you know, what you could typically get on a number of Treasury securities. But I believe it was, I can't even remember if it was honestly through March of this year, that the rate was somewhere kind of north of 5%. Don't 100% quote me on that. But I believe it was a very attractive rate to still be able to buy I-bonds. So yes, overall, I think it's a great way for folks to have a little security and to get a pretty good rate of return on the fixed income side. You might want to consider TIPS as well. Those are Treasury inflation protected securities. Again, they're designed to kind of help you out during times of rising inflation. So those would be two things, actually, that I would say to take a look at, both I-bonds and TIPS.
Patty, thanks a lot for the call. Lynette, in our last minute or two, can you talk to the person out there who maybe doesn't want to think about their money situation, doesn't want to deal with these things, or is worried, too worried to even open up the books? How can you give them a pep talk to get started?
Sure. I guess the main thing that I would say is that, as overwhelming or potentially scary sometimes as money matters can seem, it's actually worse to kind of stick your head in the sand and do nothing, or have what I call the ostrich syndrome. And that oftentimes the things that you most fear or worry or have anxiety about, A, they don't come to pass, and B, you actually feel so much better when you tackle them. Even if it's as simple as you making a things to do list and having two or three items that you put on that list to do and that you accomplish for, say, the month of March, each task that you knock off that list puts you in a better financial position, makes you stronger financially, builds those economic muscles, as it were, and it helps you for a better and brighter financial future. So don't fear, don't worry, don't have too much kind of trepidation about the state of affairs and everything. Focus on the things that you can control, the things that are within your power to do, and then get about the business of doing them.
It's a good place to leave it. Lynette, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Lynette Kalfani-Cox is also known as the Money Coach, personal financial expert, and author of a bunch of books, including Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. She was with us today for a look at the ways that inflation can affect our long-term savings and investments, and some advice on what we can do about it. Still time for you to let us know what you are doing about it, how inflation has affected you, short or long term. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, we'll look at the latest report from the ongoing Wisconsin Republican-backed 2020 election investigation. Testimony this week and a new report from the lead investigator there. We'll also check out the response from political leaders from across the political spectrum here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.